Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Ah, yes, his eye is on the sparrow, as I know he watches me. That was the rendition by talented vocalists Tina Blount and Lauryn Hill from the movie soundtrack Sister Act 2. I have loved that song for quite some time, It was a favorite of my late grandmother, Lil, and most certainly truly one of my very own favorites. You know, this life has its share of ups and downs, and it is truly by faith that we get through. I dedicate today's show to the memory of the loved one, whom are no longer here to share laughter and smile. But if we close our eyes and remember, we can still hear the sound of their voices and feel the warmth of their touch. For after their transition, their spirits now reside within us. People of the world today, I am your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is March 3rd, 2014, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Pain and loss she has endured. More pain and loss than anyone should ever expect to feel in their lifetime. There have been moments when she never felt loved or wanted. She was born into a family where she never truly fit in, which led her to a childhood spent alternating between foster care systems and mental institutions. Her nonfiction book, His Eye is on the Sparrow, is an in-depth look into the life of a battered soul, one with the horrific realities of multiple miscarriages and profound insecurity. Lisa Sparrow joins us on A Touch of Grace today, allowing us exclusive access into a life that has rose from the ashes of despair to soar into a new freedom of love and confidence. Lisa, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. How are you doing?
I am doing good, GD. Thank you. It's such an honor to be on your show.
Oh, well, welcome, welcome. I welcome you with open arms. Your life has truly seen its share of sadness. So really, how are you these days?
You know what? I am actually doing really good. It's a little cold. I live in Columbus, Ohio, so that has its own issues that no one can control, but I am doing very well. I couldn't very well write a book about depression and just suddenly magically be cured. It doesn't exactly work like that. So I am currently in counseling. I do encourage people who need it to go to get professional help, because sometimes talking to your girlfriend or your homeboy just isn't enough.
No, it's not. Clinical depression is very real, as for all of the mental illnesses. So what I would like you to do, so that the listeners will know who you are, is to take us back to the beginning and tell us where you were born and what childhood was like in your own words.
I was born in Columbus, Ohio, on Friday, February 13th, 1970, at night and during a snowstorm. And, you know, I've kind of like it is now, but I've always known that my mother has hated the day I was born, even before she said anything. It's always been very rough, always knowing that I never quite fit in no matter where I went, no matter what I did. I was always different. I didn't know what that meant at the time, and I certainly couldn't embrace it, but it was different, and it was miserable. It was painful, a lot of hurt. But I had, you know, some great people and great friends around me who really helped me through it.
I see, I see. You know, I wrote a short story for a magazine that's no longer in circulation, but it was called July's Independence, and it was a story of a young lady by the name of July Summers, and same exact scenario. The mother just could not stand her. For some reason, there was a jealousy that was created when the daughter was born because she was jealous of her own child. So did you ever find out why or what your mother's feelings were directed at?
No, you know, I'm 44 now, and to this day, I honestly do not know. I've just never really grown on her, and I've gotten to the point now where I'm okay with it. It no longer upsets me. I don't need to know why. It's not an obsession to force her to love me, because I thought I could make her love me. You know, if I just do this, I'm going to make her proud. If I just do that, she'll love me. And nothing I said or did resulted in those things. And after a certain point, I became, in my early to mid-30s, where I became accepting of it and realizing, you know what, it's okay. It's okay, and I'm not going to obsess about it anymore. It is what it is.
Right. Now, was there, okay, so there are already feelings of disparity there. So the very first thing, were you the only child, or did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I'm the oldest of her children. I have a brother and a sister underneath me.
Mm-hmm. And what were the relationships between her and those siblings?
She is absolutely crazy about them. She, my brother and sister can do no wrong. They're brilliant. They're smart. And they are. They really are. They're brilliant and smart, people. We're different. We're just different. And, I have no contact with them at all. But I mm-hmm. still believe that, you know, they're good people, and that's who she prefers. And I accept it.
Wow. So now they don't have the same father as you. Is that correct?
My brother does, but my sister doesn't.
Mm. And what was the relationship between your father and your mother like?
I'm not entirely sure. It was, as far as I'm aware, it was pretty non-existent with us growing up. She married my sister's father, so he was actually, he's the one that I call daddy. He's the one mm-hmm. that, he was the one that was there when we were growing up and whatever, you know, that's the only grandfather that my daughter knows.
Mm-hmm.
My son has since met my biological father, but there's really no relationship.
I see. So with your stepfather, what was his reaction, if there was any reaction that he had? Was he someone that you felt safe with, or was he pretty much on the same road as your mom?
No, you know what? He wasn't. Complete polar opposites. He was pretty complacent. I don't think he really wanted to rock the boat or create a ripple in any way. So he went along with whatever mommy said. It was okay with him. So, no, he never stood up and fought or defended me. I'm sorry. He did a time or two, and mm-hmm. after he figured out pretty quick it was going to be him leaving or both me and him leaving, he mm-hmm. did what she wanted to do.
Oh, my God. Well, I certainly am glad that you were strong enough to overcome and you did the things that were necessary to get yourself in a spiritual balance. So, how old were you when the feelings of being unwanted and unloved started appearing?
I was very young, probably 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
It was before I was in kindergarten. I do know that. So it was pretty young.
I see. So did she, was there ever any abuse, physical abuse that she lashed out on you, or was it mostly mental?
It was a combination of both. It was a combination of both. So, but I don't know if I want to, in her defense, I was mouthy.
Uh-huh.
And my brother would just, okay, whatever she wanted. And I was an arguer. I would argue my point right or wrong to the death. And even when I knew I was in trouble, even if I knew I was going down with the ship. So it wasn't like it was always just her. It was me too.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not an angel. So let me say that. I am not an angel. I wasn't this, you know, perfect child. And, you know, no, I was a bit of a handful, but not to the degree that I should have gotten the treatment that I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what's your relationship now with her? Is there a relationship, and does she acknowledge your children?
Yeah, we really don't have a relationship. We might talk once, maybe 2 or 3 times a year. She is absolutely crazy about my daughter. My daughter is 24.
Wow.
Yeah, she's absolutely crazy about her. And as much as she loves and just adores my daughter, is how much she can't stand, even hates me and my son. So, no, we really don't have that relationship.
Wow.
I love her. I love my family, but I feel that it's in my best mental health interest to keep a distance.
I see. It's really sad, you know, because as a child, you, when you're born into this world, you know, that's one of the greatest events in our lives when we're born. And most certainly the people closest to us usually are our parents. And to not have that bond or that security or that feeling of, you know, comfort at home.
Right.
So what was life for
right.
you outside of the house when you would go to school?
Because I was away from home. But I love anything in which I can learn and find out new things, because knowledge really is power. English and history are my strong suits, which that's where I excelled in. So while my brother and I would trade off, I would do his English and his – well, I was supposed to do his English and his history, but it got in the way of me reading my Nancy Drew books. But mm-hmm. he would do my math for me. I played volleyball and softball and different sports in high school. So that was an outlet for me, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And so what year did you graduate from high school?
I was supposed to come out in 88, but I ended up, because I was in foster care and I kept bouncing around. And not only did I bounce around from foster home to group homes and different facilities, I changed school districts. Mm-hmm. So you can't go from one district to another, a much better district, and maintain. So once I failed a couple of times, I just dropped out. So I ended up getting my GED once I got married.
I see. Well, congratulations on that, because some people never do go ahead and take that step. So the question that I have for you, okay, so you're in high school, and when you graduated, mm-hmm. Like you said, you actually didn't graduate from high school. You got your GED a little later.
Mm-hmm.
And so and you got it later on in life. So after what should have been the formative years, what would have been your high school graduation, what were those post years like after you became an adult?
Ooh, very tumultuous. Very much so. I had my daughter when I was 19, and I was homeless. I have been in and out of psychiatric hospitals since I was a teenager. So, you know, it's just up and down. Depression, suicide attempts. I mean, it was very, very rough. I didn't really have the skills needed to maintain. I mean, I always worked one or two jobs, always worked. I love working, but the depression would get in the way, or a suicide attempt. And people are afraid, like, oh, my God, if I get too close to her, it might rub off on me. And I'm suicidal, I'm not homicidal. And there's a huge, huge difference.
Oh, yeah.
that's
a huge difference.
Yes. So, and that's the thing, is that, you know, it was about surviving. And, you know, I would work, and sometimes I would be staying with somebody else, or sometimes I would be in my own apartment. And for me, being alone is one of the worst things that can happen. So, and then I was in abusive relationships that I shouldn't have been in. I just didn't want to be alone. I figured if my mom abused me, I'm supposed to be abused, so I would be in abusive relationships as well.
Wow, wow. And so when you're talking about abuse in your relationships, was there a fist? Was it an open hand type of thing? Was it that the person used something to hit you with? What was that experience like?
It's been everything. It's been mental, physical, sexual abuse. It's been punched, choked, hit, combination of everything. Just because when someone knows that you have no one that cares about you or that's going to help you, then people feel it gives them a license to do whatever it is that they want to do to you. And that further creates, you know, an issue within my own depression. Like, I'm just not good enough no matter what I do. Mm-hmm. I'm not wearing the right things, or I'm not, you know, saying the right thing, or, you know, whatever. It's just I don't measure up.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the suicide attempts,
okay.
because I could certainly relate to that, those types of feelings, though, you know, I actually came from a place that did have pretty much good love in there, and, you know, but that didn't stop the depression. Clinical depression is what it is. So let's
right.
talk about that. So when you attempted suicide, how did you try to do it?
For me, most of the time it was pills. I tried to cut my wrist one time, and that was painful. So if anybody ever said that I cut my wrist or hung myself or anything, if it involves pain, it was murder. Somebody killed me because I only do pills.
Okay.
That is the way I figure I could just go to sleep. Just go to sleep and never wake back up again.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they were not successful. So was it that someone found you and took you to the hospital, or was it something that you didn't do correctly? Well, that's apparent because you're still here with us, thank God.
Right, right.
So what happened? Did they have to pump your stomach, or what happened? How did you survive?
Yes, I have had my stomach pumped a couple of times. There were a couple of times that where people knew I had done it or knew that I was thinking about it and got to me either too late or there was one time I did almost die.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it did stop me for a long time because I was really, really sick. I was really weak. I was married at the time, and he literally had to cut my food up into little tiny baby pieces, if you will, and
oh,
I still couldn't really chew the food. It was a horrible experience. And that's the thing is that people think that people who attempt suicide are taking the coward's way out or just trying to hurt somebody. No, all I wanted was for the pain to stop. I just
mm-hmm.
wanted the pain to stop. You know, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. You don't look at the long-term repercussions. You don't see the big picture. You just want the pain to stop. You want it to go away. And if that means, you know, killing yourself, then it's not like it's a crass or a rush decision. It's something that actually a lot of time goes into. You
mm-hmm.
plan, you prepare, you know, and the thing is, and it's true, once you start giving stuff away, that's a clue. That
right.
something really bad is about to happen. Something's going down here that shouldn't quite do it. And when you have, you know, because the way that it's set up now, at least here in Columbus, Ohio, that once you have a suicide attempt, pretty much will admit you into the hospital for a 3-day psychiatric evaluation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And sometimes I've been lucky where that didn't happen, whether there were no beds or whatever the case may have been.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about mental illness, it doesn't get the same compassion a lot of the times as does cancer or some other terminal illness because
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
even in society today, people still don't get the mental illness. I mean, people
right.
can be very handsome, such as the young actor Lee Thompson Young, who committed suicide last year. Then there was
mm-hmm.
the singer, stunning singer, Phyllis Hyman, who actually went on ahead and took her life. And then we also
right.
know, you know, the late Donny Hathaway, who
mm-hmm.
had trouble with schizophrenia and all of these things. So the face of mental illness, you can't really go by because the face of mental illness could be very beautiful, very
mm-hmm.
Self-assured. But unless you really understand someone and know what they're dealing with and hence, you know, not getting treatment, and then that's when it becomes fatal. So the question I have for you,
right.
so when there was a moment in time when you actually stopped trying to kill yourself, so what was the last time and what was the light that beamed through?
Ooh, the last time was really not that long ago. It was in 2007. And it was actually after my last miscarriage. And, I mean, I really nutted up. I did not know, but I didn't know that I was on a slippery slope. I had no idea. I was in and out of the hospital. Even when they admitted me, I thought I was fine. I don't know why you people want me to be admitted into the psychiatric hospital. I'm fine. I didn't know I wasn't. And they put me on Prozac, and I had an allergic reaction to it.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
And what type of reaction did you have to Prozac?
I was in a group because I was on medical leave. I was working at a major bank at the time. And I was in group and literally flipped out. I was on a walker because I hurt myself. I couldn't use the crutches. And I called myself going to run away. They were with me every step of the way. They called the police. They got me back to the facility and transferred me into the security, the hospital security car, and took me straight to the back to the unit. We bypassed the ER and everything because I was that fresh. I was out maybe 2 weeks. And they took me right back up, and they were so disappointed to see me. And I kept saying, and the first thing they always ask is, are you taking your meds? I promise you I'm taking my meds. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to. I said, but something's wrong. I kept telling them, something is wrong. I'm taking my meds, but something is wrong. I was going to my groups. I was doing every single thing I was supposed to do, and something was not right, and nobody would listen. They assumed I wasn't taking my meds, but when they did my blood draw, they said, her meds are exactly where they're supposed to be. So it's nothing she's doing. And I had a series of seizures. And I said, you know, because you could see, remember that dance way back when called The Tick? You remember that?
I kind of remember The Tick, kind
of. Okay, well, that's what it is. Okay, I'm going to see y'all. So you could see it basically working its way up my body, and I'm like, and I'm standing there in the psych ward, and it was med time. And she's like, she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I asked my nurse and said, what's wrong? She said, I was going to ask you that. And the next thing know, I'm about to hit the floor, and she just yells for help. Nurses come from everywhere, and I'm on the floor. You know, they're trying to get the other patients because it's, everybody's scared. They're starting to flip out. And I'm by the nurse's station. And then, you know, I'm freezing. My teeth are chattering. Then I stop. But I'm still, you know how you get cold and you're just chattering. And I can't stop. And then it's coming in waves. I'm crying. I'm like, what's wrong with me? And they looked at me and they said, honey, we don't know. So 24 hours into this, it's just continuously just tearing my body apart. And then the head at the department came and said, take her off of everything. Take her off of everything. I mean, they're scared. They're looking at me. Every time I sit up, I have a seizure. Of course, you have to go to the bathroom. I have to eat. You know, they're terrified. I'm terrified, and they don't know.
Wow.
And me off of everything and put me on another medication, which has been, I think it literally saved my life, which is Cymbalta, but the copay on it was more than I could afford as a single mother.
Oh, yeah. We could talk about copays for another hour or two.
Right. I mean, but that you should never have to make a decision. Am I going to take care of my child or am I going to get my medication? That's a decision no parent should ever have to make. And, of course, my son won.
Wow, okay. So very very detailed, very introspective, very eye-opening. I definitely understand because I have witnessed it on my own. So they finally got you on the correct medication, which is great. And it sounds to me like you actually worked a way to where you will be able to get that as well, because if you are mentally ill, you definitely have to be on your medicine. So I want to go back a little bit and talk about the foster care experience. Now, I've heard horror stories. I read a book, a friend of mine whose uncle was with a young lady who actually wrote about her battles going through the foster care experience, and it was horrible because you would think that people who sign up to be foster care parents you are going to be safe, but a lot of them are just out there for the money. So what about your experience? What do you remember, the good, the bad, the ugly, about that era in your life?
You know, for the most part, GD, it was an okay experience. I've been in foster homes. I've been in group homes. I've been in the village-type settings because there were no homes available. And there was only one. It was my last foster home that I was in. It was a bad experience because it was like 14 to 18 or 15 to 18. I don't remember the exact age. But it was once, like I said, all those years, I was good. It was the last foster home. I was 17. I had turned 18. And my foster mother's grandson, who was an adult, was interested in having sexual relations with me because I was a virgin.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, very heavily in the church and believed in no sex before marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, I guess that was his, I don't know what you want to call it, but that was his mission in life, was to take my virginity. And it never worked out. I didn't want to give it to him anyway. He didn't blow my skirt up, no pun intended. When I did lose my virginity, I was so naive, I didn't know I was even having sex when I lost it. Then when I figured it out, I was like, okay, well, it's too late now. And he found out, and he told me, he raped me. And he told me the reason why he raped me is because he wanted to be the one to take my virginity. And he was mad because he didn't.
My God. So have you ever had a chance? I'm sorry. Go ahead. I want you to finish your story. Go for it.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Well, you know what? So he wanted to take your virginity. It seems to me like that's a common thread for predators. So it was unsuccessful. Is that what you said?
Yeah, because by that time I had just lost my virginity. I didn't know. I was just that naive that I didn't know that I was actually having sex.
And, you know, when I think about the foster care system, like I said, there was a woman by the name of Cupcake Brown who went on to become a lawyer. And she wrote, I actually read her story. It was a very big book, and it was horrible, some of the things that she went through while she was in the foster care system. So was there anybody that, like a social worker or somebody that would come in and check on you, or was that not the case?
For me, I very rarely actually saw my social workers. The only time I usually saw them is when they were changing my placement. So,
So
very rarely did I actually see them, which basically once you were there unless something happened. So when I was in that last foster care and I ended up going into the hospital because I had a nervous breakdown, and this is right before I got raped, that's when I saw my social worker.
Wow.
And
oh
then I never saw them again after that.
Okay. And then I'm going to make sure that I'm on the right page. So did the rape happen by the guy who tried to molest you, or was this another person who actually raped you?
This is someone else who actually raped me.
And
so it was my foster mother's grandson.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And how old was he?
He was 22 or 24.
Wow.
So just a little bit older than me.
Now, did she ever find out, or did they ever find out that he did this to you?
Yes. Yes, actually they did. I told my mother, and I told my foster care mother, and my mother said that no man rapes a woman for no reason. I had to have done something for him to have done that.
Goodness.
And, you know, there used to be a wine cooler called Bartles and James way back in the day.
Bartles and James.
And their slogan was what? Thank you for your support. And that's what I said, and I hung up on her. And so when I said something to my foster mother, they were talking. My mom and my foster mother were talking, and she said she didn't appreciate it happening in her home. I was like, well, I don't appreciate it happening at all.
Wait, okay. Let me see if I can get this straight. Okay.
Okay.
So you poor thing. Okay, so here you are in the care of this woman whose son raped you in the home. You call your mother and your mom. Okay, grandson. You call your mom, and, of course, she didn't do anything. And then the two of these women are having a discussion, and the woman goes, she didn't appreciate it having it in her own home. Oh, my Lord, you poor thing, you poor thing. It's even more of a miracle, because I, when I look at your picture, I see this bright, sunshiny face, and to know all of the hurt that you have gone through.
Thank you.
My heart goes out, and I'm so grateful that you're being so candid here so that if there's someone listening that they can tap in and to understand, because we're going to talk about the good as well.
Okay.
Now, you were married. You finally got married, and you're now divorced. Why did that marriage dissolve?
You know, I got married for the wrong reasons. He knew that when we got married that I was marrying him because I didn't think that I was going to ever get married, and he just wanted to be married. And it was there was abuse there, and I just got to the point where, you know, I can't do this because my daughter was young, and I'm telling her, don't ever let someone put their hands on you, but you see mommy having someone put their hands on her being abused. So I didn't want it to be a do as I say, not as I do type situation.
Okay, so that marriage ended because of abuse. And so was that the only marriage, or were you married again?
No, that's my only marriage.
Okay, that's the only marriage. Okay, so what a trail of just despair. I'm surprised you're still here with us. As a matter of fact, I believe that God is the reason. We were talking a little bit, going back and forth on Facebook.
Yes.
God intended for you to tell your story, and he intended to have this be used as a vessel to actually get the word out. So at what point in time in your life, with all of the wreckage, when was the defining moment when things started getting better?
You know, I had actually two moments, and that's the really funny part about it is the first moment was before I got pregnant with my son. I had left my husband, and, you know, I'm going on with my life. And that's when I started to go to church. I mean, every time the church doors opened, I was at church. For whatever reason, I just hung out with the ladies at church and just really when it was just me, I very rarely watched TV, and I didn't watch a lot of TV. My daughter was with my best friend all the time, so I would pray and read my Bible a lot. Just pray and read my Bible, and that was the first time things really started to turn around for me. I also had a dog, and I had a little Shih Tzu, and his name was Gizmo, and that was my little buddy. I could talk and cry, and I knew he wouldn't say anything. That was before Bush's, you know, Bush's baked beans came along and Duke trying to sell the family secret. But I knew that I could tell Gizmo whatever I wanted to tell Gizmo, and he was so loyal. He always stayed right there with me. And I knew that I can't wait to get home, and we're going to talk. Like, he, no, I don't hear voices, and no, I didn't think he was talking back to me. But it was nice to be able to say whatever you wanted to when you know it's not going anywhere. And it's not going to come back to haunt you. Somebody's not going to use it against you. So, and that was the thing about it is I had this wonderful dog, and unfortunately, when I got pregnant with my son, he turned on me. So I had to get rid of him, which to this day, 15 years later. Yes. 15 years later, because he bit me and my best friend, and we knew that he would probably hurt the baby. So, unfortunately, he had to go. And, I mean, it, you know, 15, my son's almost 16 now. He's probably not alive because he was abused when I got him, and he was, you know. So I'm so grateful for that dog. But the second time that things really turned around for me was about, I'm going to say 2 years ago, when I had a tragedy, which I'm actually, this is what book two is based on, where a childhood friend tried to kill me.
Oh,
and
my God.
You want to talk about a wild 18 months. And that was the time, when you're sick, what do you have a lot of on your hands? Time. You have a lot of time to think. You have a lot of time to reflect. And I was so angry at God. I was so angry. You took my babies from me. I want to be a, I love being a mommy. I've had multiple miscarriages, and I had time to reflect. And I was angry. I was so angry at God. You gave me these babies, and you snatched them away from me. And so I'm laying here thinking about that. I'm laying here in the bed thinking about, you know, I had a good life. I worked at a bank. I made good money, and, you know, we traveled. I had credit cards. I had everything. And she tried to kill me, and I had a stroke in my sleep. So not only am I'm laying in this hospital bed, I can't do anything.
Wait a minute. Let me see if I could catch up with you. Okay. What a riveting story. What a riveting life. So you had a stroke, and then that person tried to kill you?
No, she tried to kill me by giving me poison, and I had a stroke as a result of it.
Oh, my God. And why? What was her reason for trying to kill you?
The thought and theory on that is that she was trying to steal my identity. We don't look anything alike, but I had just got my tax refund. Like I said, I had a good job. I had money in the bank, was able to travel and do whatever I wanted to do. And that's what we were doing. It was just me and my baby. You know, come on, baby, let's go. We went to Atlanta. We're going to New York. We're going here. We're going there. And that's what we did. And that's the thought, that she was just going to assume my identity. She was going to, because it happened in New York, that we were going to, that she was going to kill me in New York, dump me somewhere there, bring my van back home, clean out my apartment, my storage unit. I had just bought brand spanking new furniture, and take everything back to New York because nobody knew to look for us there. As far as anybody knew, we were still in Atlanta on vacation. So, you know, and after I was, why didn't you just let me die? I lost my job while I was in rehab trying to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to write because I'm right-handed, it affected the right side of my body. I couldn't take care of my child. I couldn't drive. I couldn't do a lot of things. But I'm grateful today. Because I was at a job I hated. I was in a relationship I knew I shouldn't have been in. And I got to see who, you know, because people tell you, oh, I love you and care about you. If you need anything, let me know. But that's the type of situation that lets you know who is really down for you, who really loves you.
You could say
because
that multiple
I have a friend.
Times. You could say that multiple times.
Exactly, because I have a really good friend, and my nickname for her is Buttercup. She can't drive, and she had just had her second child via C-section, and she was willing to come and get me and my son. But it was actually my best friend who came and got us, an 18-hour drive from Columbus, Ohio, to New York. I said, just take my son and Ms. Cranberry. That's what I call my minivan, Ms. Cranberry. And she's like, I'm not leaving without you. I said, please. She was like, Lisa, I'm not leaving without you. And her name happens to be Lisa as well. And the way she said it, it wasn't open for negotiation.
Wow.
And once I got back home, I had to go back into the hospital once I got here. And then, you know, the rehab started. But it lets you know what, God didn't put me through all of this for me to keep messing up or effing up or anything. I'm supposed to be out here helping people. Because there are people out here like me who think my life is over. But look at me, everything I've been through, and not only am I blessed, but I'm blessed better than I had it before. That doesn't mean I don't struggle, because I do. I still have my depression, but I'm working through that. I'm not allowing it to control me as much anymore. my episodes don't last as long. They're shorter, and they're more, you know, spread apart.
All right, all right. Well, for those who are listening today, we are listening to author Lisa Sparrow tell her riveting story, Peril and Triumph. And so before we get into the last part of the interview today, here's some wisdom I'd like to leave you with today. We are guaranteed to know loss and sorrow in our lives because as we live, we face life on life's terms. Just as the skies above are blue, they will become stormy. And as the rain falls and the winds blow, we must always remember that after the storm, the sun will shine again. The fight for inner peace is a worthy battle. And if there are long periods of sadness and anger, listen to your mind. It is crying out for you, asking you to seek help, to open up and talk about what is bothering you. So many throw all their energies into getting that six-pack abs or wearing the fine clothes, but you cannot wear a disguise to cover pain. Our minds are vast universes of divine potential, and once we clear out the fog of adversity, we can see the stars again. If you hear nothing else today, understand this without a doubt. You are so worthy of happiness and joy, and I pray you find it. And also know this, GD loves you very much. So now we are going to return to ask some final questions of Lisa Sparrow, who was very brave and courageous today in sharing her story and hopes that it will inspire someone listening who is struggling with mental illness or are in a very adverse situation. So when did the desire for you within you lead to you actually writing the book, His Eyes on the Sparrow?
Actually, when I was still in high school, I had a friend who asked me, because, you know, I was in foster care, and she asked me, she said, what are you always writing? I said, oh, it's my diary. She said, can I read it sometime? Okay. So I gave her, like, three notebooks, and she said, you know what? You need to write a book. Oh, whatever. So over the years, different people have said that who don't, you know, they didn't know each other. And I had started writing it probably about 13 years ago, and it got deleted twice. And the last time it got deleted was on my floppy, so I'll let you know how long ago that was, right after I had my stroke. And when I put it on my zip drive, it changed everything because it did not start out to be a story about depression. It started to it's still being about my life. But then after it got deleted the third time, that's when the whole focus became on mental illness and depression. And actually I'm glad it did because what we see on the news so frequently these days are about the tragedies of, you know, the Navy Yard shooting or the young lady in D.C. or the Sandy Hook shooting, all these massacres. And what people really need to understand is that to plan something like that takes a lot of energy. I can't imagine. Planning dinner some days is just too much. Oh, I planned dinner now. I got to go down, lay down and take a nap. So then to acquire the weapons and the ammunition, that's just too much more than we can handle, for just being honest. We are everyday people. We're mothers and fathers. We're business people. We're pastors, sports authorities, actresses, actors. We are in every walk of life. It does not matter what your social standing is, your financial status, what you look like or what you think you look like. It doesn't matter your sexual orientation, your nationality. It doesn't care. Mental illness is an equal opportunist.
Oh, yeah. It definitely is.
It doesn't care. And if you don't take care of it, it's going to take care of you. I suggest that people, if you think you need help, go get the help. It doesn't matter what other people say. You have to do what's right for you, regardless of what that may be or how someone else, you know. In the black community, we don't talk about mental illness. It's more acceptable to have someone in prison than it is to say Aunt Lisa is crazy, so we got her locked in the back room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so now with this book that you have out, with this book that you have out, because it really tells your story, where can it be purchased? Is there a website or where is it available?
It is available. My wonderful editor, Cassetta Jefferson, at Virtuous Ink Publishing, she's in transition right now. So she's in a couple of weeks, you'll be able to place an order. But if you go to my website, which is www.hiseyesonthesparrow.com, or my Facebook page, Lisa Y. Sparrow, then you can it'll direct you to my website or to direct you to Amazon to place an order. So, I mean, it's very accessible. And, you know, like I said, this is something that we need to actually talk about, because we're not all bad people.
No, we're not. And you know what? I'm glad that you reaffirmed that several times during the broadcast, because it is real. Mental illness is real. People concentrate on the physical, outer, but the mental is so fragile. And if you've gone through anything, especially the list of things that you've gone through, your mom didn't care that much for you. You know, you get into a foster care system, you were raped, someone tried to kill you. I mean, it's almost like, I remember in 1989 when we had the Loma Prieta earthquake, and I went home and I saw my apartment, and it was, in shambles. And there was like a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that happened. Certain things hit your life, and you really do have to work with them to find a peace so that you could go ahead and keep on living as a productive member of society. So what I want to do, now that we know where your book can be found, I just want to tell the listeners about two more shows coming up this week, and then we're going to come back to you, Lisa, for your final thoughts. So think about something you want to leave the listeners with today, okay?
Okay.
Okay. All right. So A Touch of Grace is growing. It is 30,000 strong. I ask or extend invitations if people seek me out to actually be on the show. People like Lisa Sparrow, who is courage. She is actually courage in this life, a visible courage for anyone to see, to have hope. So later on this week, we're going to get back into the entertainment sector, and we're going to have Anthony Wayne on Thursday from the stage show Mighty Real, a fabulous Sylvester musical. So if you remember the songs You Make Me Feel Mighty Real, You Are My Friend, that the late Sylvester James sung, well, there's a show out about his life, and it's currently in New York. So the performer who's playing Sylvester will be on the show on this Thursday at 1:30. Then on Friday, best-selling author William Cooper with his latest book, Unbreakable. He has been acknowledged in Essence magazine and has been a best-selling author for a number of years. So I'm excited about that. He actually sent me the book to go through, so I'm going to try to get through some chapters. But most certainly, I want to thank you so much for the support of the show. It really is growing. If you know you or someone else who needs exposure, get in touch with me at my email address, authorgdgrace@gmail.com. Back to Lisa. Lisa, what final thoughts would you like to leave listeners with today?
If you need help, go get it. Whether you make an appointment to see a mental health professional or go to the ER and say, this is how I'm feeling, I need help. If you have a support system, which I highly recommend, have your support person go with you. Do whatever it takes to be able to get yourself back in that happy place, because the sun will shine again. Today might be bleak, but tomorrow might be better. And if you can't look at tomorrow, let's do it moment by moment, because sometimes day by day is a little bit too much of a stretch. I know that for me, on my website, I talk about safety nets. Sometimes I have to watch cartoons, and there's no shame in my game. I have to do what makes me happy. And I don't have a substance abuse problem, thankfully, but I'm an emotional eater, so I can relate to that. So I'm not going to say eat your way through a chocolate cake, even though it sounds like a wonderful thing to do. If it's just cut a piece of that chocolate cake, get a Happy Meal and watch some cartoons. Or talk to somebody. Do whatever it takes. Find your support system. You're going to need more than one. And pray. Surround yourself with people who love you. They don't have to understand. But as long as they love you, that's going to get you through it. And if you feel that you can't talk to the people around you, find someone you can talk to. Email me. My email is lisasparrow41@gmail.com. It always looks darkest before the dawn. There is hope. I am living proof. Never, ever give up, no matter how bad things seem.
Beautiful, beautiful. And I thank you for the lovely spirit that is you, Lisa, and I encourage you to keep on in the fight. I'm always here. We've established a friendship now, so if you need someone
yes.
to talk to, know that GD is here for you, okay?
Thank you so much, GD. I appreciate it, and I extend the same offer to you. Thank you.
All right. All right. People of the world, thank you so much for tuning in today. It has been an honor to have Lisa Sparrow, the author, on the show today. Go out and support her book, His Eyes on the Sparrow. It's available at her website, as she mentioned earlier. And also, if you have not learned how to love yourself yet, do some soul searching, because really, you really are okay. All right? Love you lots.